Hello, it's Owen Shehan here from Off The Ball, and the FIFA World Cup 2026 is here. And let's be honest, the matchday version of ourselves can look a little committed. Jerseys, face paint, scarves and questionable weather, whatever you have, maybe even a full costume if your team makes a run, you can look a little worse for wear come the end of it all. But the World Cup, it's not just about the football. It's the atmosphere, it's the nights in the pub, it is the watch parties with your mates, and maybe even meeting someone new. That is where Lynx comes in. As an official personal care sponsor of the FIFA World Cup 2026, Lynx's premium fragrances are here to help you smell your best, even in the middle of full matchday madness. Lynx, smell your best when you look your worst. Now, enjoy your podcast.
The Racing Pod.
Looking ahead to this year's Galway races? Then don't miss The Racing Pod live with Off The Ball. Join me, John Duggan and Johnny Ward, alongside special guests Joe Canning, Barry Geraghty and Paul Nolan, for an afternoon of racing insight, expert tips and plenty of crack. We'll be live from Mary Mullins Pub on Tuesday, July the 28th, previewing all the big action from Ballybrit with thanks to William Hill. Tickets are on sale now at offtheball.com/events. The Racing Pod live, July the 28th at Mary Mullins Pub. 18 plus. See gamblingcare.ie.
Off The Ball.
Off The Ball daily.
We have quite simply the most remarkable week of sport, and what a Sunday it could be, which includes the last round of the oldest major, at least in my opinion, the greatest of the majors, the Open Championship at Royal Birkdale, which has such a storied history when it comes to the claret jug. Previous winners include Arnold Palmer, and of course in 2007, when Padraig Harrington finally got the better of Sergio Garcia to land his major there. John Hogan is with us, golf writer. John, how are you keeping?
I'm very well, enjoying this lovely warm weather.
Ah, it's amazing. The only thing is, it doesn't really feel like open weekend, because for the last while, John, I've got used to the wind protecting the course, wet conditions, yeah. The fairways that look green and lush. And then I was looking at some of the pictures of Birkdale earlier on, and the grass has been burned because of the good weather we're having. And realistically, I think some of the wind is going to blow in from the east for the first 2 days. It might not be the factor that it has been in previous years.
Well, I kind of like the sound of all that, because you know, when the course is a little bit hard and bouncy, we're going to get a few bad bounces, and we're going to get a lot of whining from the players, which I always like to hear.
Look, anything that makes them look like mere mortals like us.
Exactly.
But this is beautifully set up for this week just gone by. So we've got some very happy Irish memories with Harrington back in 07, but we've got a huge Irish field, particularly with some amateurs qualifying over the last few weeks as well. I might talk about them in a bit. And you've got like Rory McIlroy coming in reasonable form off the Scottish Open from last week as well, John. He's decided to take his lightest schedule since 2017. He's only played at 12 tournaments this year, but that's very clearly a case of him managing his load and maybe to an extent managing the injury he had earlier in the season as well.
Well, I think that, you know, the Masters win last year gave Rory a freedom that he's quite clearly enjoying. He's I spoke to him last week at the Scottish Open, and, you know, he's in the position, you know, he understands his position in the game. I saw him at the Australian Open at the back end of last year, which was a perfect indication of the influence that he can have on any event, really. I mean, the crowds were amazing just because he was there. But he's enjoying that freedom. I mean, I think he's now doing pretty much whatever he wants to do, whenever he wants to do it. I mean, he's having a wee, you know, he kind of denied it when I put it to him that he was playing chicken with the PGA Tour over the number of events he's going to play this year. But, oh, no. But he knows fine that the PGA Tour are in no position to punish him in any way. I mean, they need Rory McIlroy playing in as many events as possible, and that's not going to change.
I think previously as well, he just played a bit too much, especially after he won his Masters first time around. He felt like he had to almost represent it around the world, and he was going off to play in Australia, as you mentioned. He played the Irish Open here, and it was so important to him to be seen to play in it. And he took on such a heavy schedule that year. While, as you say, maybe he's been liberated this time around, and maybe he's got that feeling now that he doesn't have to talk about Liv in every single press conference that he has to go to, that Rory McIlroy can go by the beat of his own drum to a certain extent.
Yeah, well, I think that you're right. I think that's freed him up. His mind away from tournament golf. He's not got stuff to think about now. They've got a new house at Wentworth, and he's got a young family, and you know everybody's got to get that right. I mean, you forget that these people have lives as well as, you know, tournament golfers. But Yeah, I mean, I'm with him all the way. I mean, I think Rory is he's the biggest draw in golf, and he can do whatever he wants. And he's obviously reveling in that at the moment. There was a little smile on his face last week when I put it to him. But yeah, he knows exactly where he is in the world of golf.
The form on a year is fairly important when it comes to the Open, at least in recent times. So I was just checking this out. So 8 of the last 9 winners had already won a tournament earlier in the year. So it's an illustrious enough pack who've won a tournament up until this point this season. Rory McIlroy will hope that that's a good sign for him as well. But generally, somebody doesn't just bolt out of nowhere to win the Open. That's been the recent experience.
Well, certainly not at Birkdale. If you look at the list of winners, it's a pretty impressive list. I think only Muirfield would be the, you know, in terms of the list of champions on there, on Muirfield is, you know, second to none. But Birkdale would be a close second to that. I mean, you've got to be a pretty damn good golfer to win at Birkdale. You're either already established as a really good player, or you're at that time just about the best player on the planet. I mean, Marco Mira would be a great example of that in 1998. Mm-hmm. For that year, he'd already won the Masters, and he arrived at Birkdale as probably the hottest golfer out there, and it proved. But plus, Birkdale it's got a reputation as a kind of fair, I mean, in inverted commas. I'm not sure I always like that when it comes to links golf. It's not supposed to be fair. I don't really want it to be fair. As I said earlier, I'd like to see a few bad bounces, and because that's part of the test, is to be able to handle that kind of thing when you're playing in links golf.
I was reading Scotty Scheffler's transcript of his press conference yesterday, and he was saying that it'd been a while since he'd been back to the course, and he was having a look at maybe some of the changes around 14, 15, 16. So how significant have the changes been to the course since they last played the major here, John?
Well, there's a new hole, basically, and a par 3. I spoke to Adam Scott last week at the Scottish about the new hole. It's a 250-yard par 3. So I said to him, well, what do you think? And he goes, well, does anybody like a 250-yard par 3? So I don't think he was too impressed. I'm not sure that people are going to fall in love with that. It would have been nicer if they'd come up with a 140-yard monster, you know, something like the postage stamp or the 11th that we saw at Shinnecock Hills at the US Open last month. I mean, it's only a 9-iron or a wedge, but it's a nightmare for these guys the penalty for missing. But the 250-yard one, well, you know, how interesting is that really? Not very.
Yeah, but that's it. I mean, you want something to be iconic if it's going to be a par 3 in that circumstance. One that's just a little bit longer off the tee doesn't sound very interesting to me.
No, well, it wouldn't be, I don't think. I mean, I think it'll be a hard par, depending on the conditions, but you know, hard doesn't always make it interesting.
Indeed. I mentioned Scotty Scheffler, and it's such a rare thing for him to miss a cut. So he goes nearly 80 tournaments without doing so, 4 years, and then misses one at the Scottish Open last week. So what's your assessment of where Scheffler is coming into this week?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, he's clearly not quite what he was in previous years. It's not been terrible. I think he's still top of the money list, if there's still such a thing in America. But he's not the same. There are little errors there all over his game as well. It's not as if it's, you know, we can point to driving or putting or iron play. It's been a bit of everything for him that's been a bit off. And it's just enough for him not to win. I mean, I wrote a column, you know, a few months ago about him, saying that his super strength or superpower was the ability to just keep going at the highest, at a very high level, longer than anybody else. And that was kind of why he won tournaments, or so many tournaments. But he's not been doing that, or he's been a wee bit unlucky and finding somebody every week who's playing that bit better than he is. You know, it's been a variety of people. I mean, that was always Rory's thing for a while. It wasn't the same guy who was beating Rory every week. It was some guy just on a hot week and would pop up. And there's been a bit of that for Scheffler as well. I mean, and that's just golf. I mean, even Tiger didn't dominate completely. I mean, he came closer than anybody else has probably. But he didn't win every single tournament. And that's the same for Scottie Scheffler.
We also, I think, put such a high bar and a standard on Scottie Scheffler as well, understandably because of what he's done. I think of 2 years ago where it felt like, with the exception of maybe some putting performances which weren't totally there, we still thought Scottie Scheffler was just a machine, week on, week on, week on, on the PGA Tour. Yeah. And then generally around the majors, he was thereabouts all the time as well. It's difficult, and nobody really since Tiger has been able to have that type of run of form since what we saw in Scheffler kind of 2024, that period.
Yeah, I mean, he was amazingly consistent, but I'm always a bit wary of the word consistent. Mm. I've watched players over the years, people like Seve and Sandy Lyle, who were, you know, not at times in their lives were the best player on the planet. And then they sort of change things in an effort to become, in inverted commas, more consistent. Well, if I was Seve or Sandy Lyle, I would rather win five tournaments every year and miss every other cut rather than finish seventh every week. I've never understood this consistency thing. I mean, golf at the top level is about hitting home runs. Mm. It's not about bunting singles. So, as I say, consistency, not for me, you know.
And maybe that's something that someone like Shane Lowry would feel. You know, if he can get to his 2019 level, that's more important than what happens in the years in between. And he said back then, you know, he's probably got another, after 2019, probably another 10 to 15 chances to win another Claret Jug. So here we are kind of halfway through that cycle now. He's had a real kind of mixed bag of a season so far. But what do you think Shane's chances are of potentially winning a second Open this week?
Well, I think the hardest thing for Shane is going to be after he gets himself in contention. I think that's relatively easy for him, on particularly on links golf. He's got a beautiful game that's made for playing by the seaside, but he's had a couple of really hard knocks this year where he's put himself, and he's basically thrown away two tournaments. I'm thinking of the one in Dubai at the start of the season, and then the Honda, what used to be the Honda Classic, I'm not sure what they call it now, but the one in Palm Beach, which he should have won as well. Those are things that play on the mind. So as I say, the easiest thing, if you can call it that, for Shane will be to get himself in position to where he got a chance to win. The hardest thing will be then taking that chance.
And the thing as well is the only way to put those ghosts to bed is actually to go and win a big tournament after that. Because I think of what he would admit himself was a collapse at the US Open on the last day in 2016. He had to wait for Royal Port Rush to kind of put that to bed.
Yeah, I was there for that. I mean, it was a funny thing that Oakmont. I mean, Oakmont might be the hardest course on the planet. Certainly one of the more difficult US Open courses, and he didn't cope well with it. I mean, I think it basically came down to the fact that he wasn't ready, and he kind of knew that, and that's an easier thing to deal with. Padraig Harrington had the same kind of thing. He had to go through a few near things in majors until he realised, oh, I'm good enough to win one of these things. And I think Shane probably took the same attitude coming away from Oakmont back in 2016.
Padraig Harrington and Birkdale, of course, it is so emotional. Padraig obviously has been on this brilliant run the last while with the senior, winning the US senior again just a few weeks ago. And it's just, again, I saw the movie of it on Sky Sports earlier on, where they were going back to that year, himself and Sergio, who I think, admittedly, Padraig Harrington probably wasn't Sergio Garcia's biggest fan. But again, the idea of him getting over the line, the picture he still has in his home of the ladybirds in the claret jug, all that type of stuff. There's fantastic romance attached to Padraig Harrington getting over the line in that Open Championship back in 07.
Yeah, well, he said many times in interviews, you've probably seen it yourself, that the second Open was a big deal for him because he kind of collapsed over the line, if you like, at Carnoustie when he beat Sergio eventually in the playoff. I mean, he was very fortunate there. He'll tell you that himself. I mean, he double bogeyed the last hole and got up and down. I mean, it was almost John Vandeveld stuff going on. And he was lucky to get away with that. And I think he realised that. But on the other side of it, it left him with something to prove. He didn't want to be remembered for winning the Open in that fashion. And he certainly showed that a year later. I mean, he was the best player in the field by a distance and proved it. And, you know, that was how you would want to be remembered as a champion, far more than the flopping over the line he did at Carnoustie.
No, for sure. And they always say that a great champion can, you know, follow up the success previously, where it's not a flash in the pan. And I remember the great former golf commentator Bob Bubka, around about that time when he went to the PGA Championship, was calling it the potential Paddy Slam. Such was the form that Paddy Harrington was on in that period, kind of 06, 07, 08. Yeah. So unfortunately, it wasn't to be that year, but I always did enjoy that every time Bob went on the commentary, he was saying maybe the Paddy Slam might just happen for Padraig Harrington.
Yeah, well, Bob had one of the great voices, that's for sure.
Amazing, absolutely amazing. And you know the funny part, Bob in his later years very rarely got out in the course. He always would have said to us the best way for him to actually work at a golf tournament, and only when you go to work them you realise there's some truth in this, he used to book a hotel room very close to the golf course, and he found it was much easier actually just to follow on TV than being there, because you'll know this, the experience of going, you can kind of commit to one thing or the other. I will go out and I will follow Scottie Scheffler, or I will follow Rory McIlroy for the afternoon, or I stay in the media centre and try and actually see as many shots as possible.
Well, I fell foul of that. The last time you're talking about Padraig Harrington winning at Birkdale, I don't know if you remember the first day, certainly the first half of the day, was the weather was brutal. And Padraig was out in the morning, and I, in a moment of madness, decided I was going to follow him. So I was out there for all 18 holes, and I came in. I mean, you know, I was the drowned rat, proverbial drowned rat. I don't know how he played golf. And I tell you what, the biggest, maybe the biggest feat that he achieved that week was winning from that half of the draw, because that was a huge disadvantage to be playing in the morning on the first day, and yet he still managed to win.
That is a challenge when it comes to links golf particularly. You might just, I suppose, for the listener, explain this maybe. I appreciate that this week might be a little bit different weather-wise to sometimes what we get at the Open, but it is a course that is very much set up for links-style golf. Yeah, a lot of the American players say this is a tricky adjustment. It's why they come over and play the Scottish Open or play a few tournaments to get their eye in, or maybe some practice in Ireland before they go and play the Open. But how different is it compared to the largely parkland courses that most of the world's top players are playing in America?
Well, it's potentially a huge difference. I mean, you know, it's that's the reason we're right by the sea, and it's tidal. And with the tides change, so the wind changes or can change. I mean, you can have a huge difference between an early start one morning to playing, you know, fairly late in the afternoon. And that can make the difference between winning and losing. I mean, my mind goes back to St. Andrews in 2010 when Louis Oosthuizen won by a mile. He played early on the second day when it was pretty much flat calm for the first 16 holes of his round. And Rory played in the afternoon. Admittedly, Rory played, you know, pretty poorly, but he shot 81 or whatever it was he shot. But I've always said that if Rory had played in the morning at the same time with Louis Oosthuizen and played, Rory would have won that by about 12 shots that tournament, because he started with 63, I think. 63-81, I think, from memory. But that shows you what effect the draw can have. I mean, Rory was finished, obviously. He wasn't going to win after that second round. But if he'd played early in the morning, I have no doubt in my mind that he would have won it.
I enjoy when some of the weather changes on people too. Like, I remember Tiger going around effectively on one leg, you know, making sure that you would win. And you have to sometimes battle the conditions as much as battle your own physical condition when it comes to this. And, actually watching someone having to battle through, having to be very constructive with their shots, just as a golf fan, I think that's one of the things that makes the Open really special.
Well, the thing to look for, I mean, I grew up on a link, so, you know, at least I know how to do it, or I'm not very good at doing it, but I know how to do it, is the height of the shots. It's not so much the length of the shots, it's the height of the shots, that people who can vary the height of the trajectory of their particularly their iron shots, they are the ones that do especially well in those conditions. And that's where Shane Lowry scores. I mean, I've been a huge fan of Shane Lowry's, the way he plays, because it's old-fashioned and it's a bit handsy. Even long before he won his major, I was Shane Lowry's number one proponent. I thought I'd loved watching him play. You know,
I remember watching him at the Baltry, basically playing in those exact type of conditions when he won the Irish Open. And, you know, I think he went through various different jackets and he had to find a way of teeing the ball a little bit lower and just find a way of getting over the line. And he was soaked in champagne by Rory McIlroy at the end, but also soaked by the weather conditions in County Louth as well. It was a really good setup for being good at links golf after that. The man who finished second to him back in Royal Portrush in 19 was Tommy Fleetwood. Potentially he could be the ultimate hometown hero this weekend if he wins here.
Well, it's the romantic story of the week, isn't it? I mean, and I think the way Tommy has played, he's, you know, getting back to consistency. There is very few players in the world are more consistent than Tommy. Where he doesn't win as often as he would like, and certainly I would like, that probably because he doesn't putt as well as he could do, especially down the stretch. But I tell you what, if conditions are tricky and it's not just a putting contest and it's not some like 18 under is going to win, I think that helps him. That brings him back into play. His strengths will count for more if the conditions are a little bit more difficult. Plus, you know, I mean, I do smile a little bit when people say, "Oh, it's his home. You know, it's his home, and he'll play Royal Birkdale a lot." He was a working class boy. I bet he didn't play Royal Birkdale very often unless he sneaked over the fence. You know, the Royal Birkdale wasn't the membership there. It's not made up of young Tommy Fleetwoods, that's for sure.
No, absolutely. I think as well, though, he is most people's second favourite golfer. I think back to the Tour Championship of last year, people are just willing him to get over the line. And now one of those things missing in the CV for him is a major. And I think if your favourite golfer isn't in contention this coming weekend, I think most neutral fans would love to see him lift the Claret Jug.
Yeah, well, he's such a nice person. I mean, that comes across in interviews. And I've dealt with him in a professional fashion over the years, and he's always the same. He's always helpful. He's always nice. If he doesn't have time, he'll tell you he doesn't have time. But if he does have the time, you get the time. He's not one of these guys that says after 3 or 4 minutes, "Oh, have you got all you need?" He'll stand there and answer questions as long as you want to do it, which is not always the way with especially a leading player.
Stuart Grenn is part of this field, so he won the amateur in wonderful style a few weeks back, and I think there's probably no better golden ticket when it comes to golf. So in Stuart's case, he went professional, by his own admission found it difficult to maybe make a trade because it's difficult on the lower reaches of the tours. Then he decided to go back re-amateur, wants to play Walker Cup, wins the amateur championship, and now he punches his ticket for this tournament, also the US Open and the Masters next year as well. I think there's no better prize in golf than winning the amateur, is there?
Well, I would agree with you. But you don't see many of the leading Americans coming over to play in it. Mm. The winners of the amateur over the years, the last maybe 20 years or so, maybe more, they haven't done very well, as you say, when they've stepped up to the Open and the Masters and the US Open. I mean, there's the odd one here and there. I mean, Sergio, that kind of thing, Alathabal maybe. But generally speaking, they have not done very well, and that reflects on the field in the amateur. I mean, good luck to Stuart for winning. I mean, you've got to play damn well to win these things. Let's hope that he's the exception that proves the rule. I mean, if you look at the history books, the amateur champions have not distinguished themselves too much when they've stepped up a level.
No, and the head scratcher for me always is it falls on the weekend of the US Open. So he goes as part of his invite for next year. So very rarely does the winner of the amateur championship ever go back to defend their title because they've got a slightly
just
bigger occasion.
Thing. Yeah. Yeah. It's weird, isn't it? Yeah. It used to be the amateur, way back in the day, it was the first week in June. Mm. It didn't clash with the US Open before, so they've moved it for whatever reason. You'd have to ask the RNA about that.
I know. It's a pity as well, because from an Irish eyes point of view, we were all interested to see how he'd get on, so it didn't lose traction over here. But understandably, there's a massive major on at the same time, and golf fans are obviously drawn that direction. It looks as well, John, as if the Open may well happen in the Republic of Ireland for the first time. So again, a very positive update today on Portmarnock, which came from Mark Darbin of the RNA. He was saying that they've been in contact with the Irish government. All the soundings are good. He says it's a complicated venue because of just the scale of the Open Championship, and I know they've kind of spoken about that before, but he said after the feasibility study they're very hopeful. He said the work, quote, is pretty much done. We've confirmed that we believe we can take the Open Championship there, in reference to Portmarnock. So it seems it might not be next year or the year after, but it looks like it is closing in and actually happening now.
Well, I'd be all for that. I mean, there was only two things holding back Portmarnock. I mean, the quality of the golf course was never in doubt. Yeah. It was just getting in and out was one factor, and the fact that they didn't have women members was the other one more recently. Now, both of those things, I think, are pretty much fixed. So why would you not go to play at Portmarnock? I mean, the golf course is wonderful. I played in a long-ago home internationals there in the early 80s and fell in love with the place. It's a terrific venue. I mean, there's absolutely nothing bad you could ever say about Portmarnock as an Open venue, other than the two things that we just covered, and fix them, and why not? Let's go for it.
It expands the nature of the Open to a certain extent by coming to this side of Ireland, but given the good experiences we've had in Portrush over the last, 6-7 years with the two recent hostings, they had bumper crowds, an amazing time. I know a lot of people would have went north of the border to go and watch them as well. We might not use the British Open moniker for that week just down here when we're talking about it.
Well, I spent much of my working life working for Golf Digest in America, and it always amused me that when we did go back to Portrush, I said, well, you do realise that the British Open, as you call it, isn't being played in Britain this year. How are you going to handle that? It made me laugh.
And how did they handle it? They just ploughed on with British
Open?
Well,
they just ignored it. They just call it everyone calls it the British Open over there, which is, you can kind of understand that, but it's nice. Actually, another thing about going to Portmarnock is that the championship is living up to its name. There is no reason why it shouldn't be played in the Republic of Ireland, or anywhere indeed, for that matter.
Indeed, absolutely. Yeah, it makes it that little bit more interesting too, and it kind of spreads the available venues that are going to be there too for the Open in the coming years. So it should be absolutely fantastic. I can't let you go without giving me a prediction of who you think is going to win this week.
Well, I you touched on it. You've kind of stolen my thunder. I'm a Fleetwood guy. I'm a bit of a romantic at heart, although people would find that hard to believe, probably. But he'd be my number one wish for winning. But I think Rory's due again. He's just bubbly. He's just playing well enough coming in without, you know, people. It'd be slightly, if Rory can ever be under the radar, that's the situation he's in. Nobody's going, oh, Rory's going to definitely win this, you know, for sure. And that might be working to his advantage. So Tommy Fleetwood and Rory would be my two.
Do you know what? I appreciate we all work in narratives here, and we had that decade of Rory, will he, won't he, how many majors will he end up, and so on. Slowly but surely, if he was to win this and he starts going closer to 10 majors at that stage, it's this kind of remarkable, I won't call it a second chapter in his career, but the 30s chapter of his career becomes all the more interesting, where I think we'll always remember that barren period by his standards will be now resilience to see what he could do in his later 30s.
Yeah, but I think he's now at the stage where he's looking around for things to achieve. Mm. I think, he mentioned winning the Ryder Cup in America, that he did that last year. I think the Open at St Andrews next year will be a big target. Winning at St Andrews is kind of career defining in itself. And I do think that he will want to be the European golfer with the most major wins. So he needs to get to 8 to achieve that. Maybe when he forgets about Harry Vardon, he's the leader with 7. It's not Nick Faldo on 6, but modern day golfers, that's another target for Rory, is to get past Faldo.
Nick Faldo will have you believe he's right out there in his own, by the way.
That Rory is, or that Nick Faldo is.
No, that he is himself.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. I was Nick Faldo's ghostwriter for a few years, and yes, there's a little bit of self-absorption going on there, to put it mildly.
I joke. I do enjoy Nick's contributions when I see him on the TV, and I'm sure he'll be with some of the broadcasters for this coming week as well. John, enjoy the Open Championship. Pleasure as always.
You too. Nice to be on. Thanks.
Off the Ball Daily.
Hello, it's Owen Chehan here from Off The Ball, and the FIFA World Cup 2026 is here. And let's be honest, the matchday version of ourselves can look a little committed. Jerseys, face paint, scarves and questionable weather, whatever you have, maybe even a full costume if your team makes a run, you can look a little worse for wear come the end of it all. But the World Cup, it's not just about the football. It's the atmosphere, it's the nights in the pub, it is the watch parties with your mates, and maybe even meeting someone new. That is where Lynx comes in. As an official personal care sponsor of the FIFA World Cup 2026, Lynx's premium fragrances are here to help you smell your best, even in the middle of full matchday madness. Lynx, smell your best when you look your worst. Now, enjoy your podcast.